Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, February 16th, 2023. Expanded affordable housing development planned for Alpine, raising infrastructure concerns, by Allegra Hobbs, A-L-L-E-G-R-A at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. When a developer came before Alpine City Council last week seeking approval for a new affordable housing complex, officials found themselves caught between two imperatives equally vital to the city's future: the need to create more housing and the need to swiftly address the ailing infrastructure that could be further strained by development. Ultimately, council opted to pursue both goals concurrently, giving the proposed development a verbal green light while initiating a feasibility study to identify potential infrastructure issues. The discussion around the intersecting topics underscored the challenges facing Alpine as it seeks both to attract growth and to address persistent, unaddressed maintenance problems. Developer Investment Builders Incorporated plans to expand its Skyway Gardens development on Lekagiga Road by nearly double, adding an additional 44 units of housing to the existing 49-unit complex. While 2 to 4 of those new 44 units will be rented at market rate, said Investment Builders Senior Vice President Roy Lopez, the rest will be below market rate units set aside for low-income renters. But while there was no debate as to the value or necessity of more housing options in Alpine, immediate support of the proposal was halted by concerns over the aging water system that would service the development. City Manager Megan Antrim explained that it was not a question of whether Alpine could provide water to the development or to other residents, but whether increased service at the Skyway Gardens site would worsen water pressure issues for residents who live further south. In the absence of a feasibility study, said Antrim, it was impossible to predict how the expanded development would impact water service, if at all. I know that you are willing to work with us, but I don't know what's going to happen once you do, Antrim told Investment Builders representatives at the February 7th meeting. We don't know if we'll have issues with water pressure. It's unfortunately a what-if game. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Antrim explained that the what-if game is due to the city's poor history of data keeping. It is known anecdotally that the south side of town has suffered water pressure issues, perhaps due to the city's use of a gravity-fed water system, but there is not enough information to determine whether those issues would be exacerbated by development further north. It is unknown, for instance, whether the water lines currently installed are large enough to carry a sufficient amount of water across the city. There's not enough data that's easily obtainable to know what the impact of a new development would do, said Antrim. A feasibility study to gather that data was set in motion last week, said Antrim, and will take between 30 and 90 days to complete. Information gathered through that study will be used to direct engineers tackling upgrades throughout the city. Antrim plans to apply for grants to help cover necessary upgrades. As the new development will not be completed for about 2 years, Antrim said the hope is that any identified issues can be addressed before the units are filled. In the meantime, following a prolonged discussion, council gave Investment Builders verbal confirmation that it would support the new development, called Skyway Gardens 2. Senior Vice President Lopez explained to officials that he was up against a March 1st deadline to apply for a 9% housing tax credit through the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, TDHCA. Through the TDHCA Housing Tax Credit Program, the federal government allocates tax credits to the state government, which then awards the credits to developers of below market rate rental properties through a competitive process. The chosen developers then sell the tax credits to private investors for funding. The idea is to incentivize developers to create below market rate housing by offsetting part of their tax liability. In order to be eligible for below market rate units in these developments, a renter's income must fall under a certain amount, determined by the area median income, AMI. Skyway Gardens 2 will include units available for those earning up to 30% of Alpine's AMI, units for those earning up to 50% of the AMI, and those earning up to 60% of the AMI. Exact dollar figures are difficult to determine in advance, said Lopez, because Alpine's AMI may change in the roughly 2 years it will take for construction to wrap up. The most recently available census data indicates that Alpine's area median income as of 2021 was $43,583, rounding up to the nearest dollar. 30% of that figure would be an income of $13,075. 50% would be $21,792, and 60% would be $26,150. If a family moves into one of the units, their combined income could not exceed the prescribed AMI percentage. Lopez said the affordable units would go for an average of 25% below market rate. At the existing Skyway Gardens property, which has the same AMI constraints, a one-bedroom goes for $743 to a renter earning 60% of AMI, $610 to a renter earning 50% of AMI, and $342 to a renter earning 30% of AMI, according to Lopez. Councilmember Judy Stokes, while still expressing support for the development, impressed upon fellow council members that the requirement of such low income levels would exclude certain professions that Alpine was attracting or seeking to attract, namely teachers and Border Patrol agents. They're making too much money, so we have a limited population that we're helping out, said Stokes. I have a Border Patrol son. He couldn't have gone down there and rented. Antrim, who said city employees would also not qualify for the below market rate units, said she saw the housing as creating the opportunity for lower income residents to leave their current homes for a more affordable option, and in the process creating more available housing for those earning closer to the area median income. Lopez told the Sentinel he sees a demand for the units in Alpine. There is currently a wait list for units in the existing Skyway Gardens, he said, which hovers at near capacity. It's affordable housing, and that's what people need over there, said Lopez. We know the demand is out there. Our market study shows that the demand is out there. Our waiting list shows that the demand is out there. And that's why we said it's a good fit to do a second phase out there. Mayor Catherine Eves, in an interview with the Sentinel, agreed, adding that the increased availability of affordable housing could help fill positions at local businesses. We need the housing. We need it desperately, said Eves. This particular development will help Alpine's current needs. We have a lot of positions available for people to work. We just need the workers, and the housing will help that. The developer will have to return to council for a set of approvals beyond the verbal endorsement. First, council will have to vote to annex the land, currently outside city limits, into the city. Council will also be asked to provide a written letter of support and a will serve letter, pledging to provide gas and water to the site. At last week's meeting, Antrim noted that the lingering unanswered questions around the development's potential impacts could, in part, be attributed to the fact that the city had not planned for such developments to be brought into the city. "The city didn't plan for development," she said. "This is looking farther out into the county areas and annexing these properties." Councilmember Chris Rodriguez argued that the need for housing was so dire, the city would have to take on the potential risks, and pointed to the recent controversial annexation of the property on which Alpine's third Dollar General will be built. "That's the chance that we're taking, and we can't stop just because of that," said Rodriguez. "We just let Dollar General in, not knowing what it was going to do. I understand we're talking about more usage of water, but I have questions on whether we can actually afford to wait." Rodriguez went on to say that Alpine was absorbing some of the population from neighboring Marfa, where housing is scant. "We have people that are trying to come in from Marfa, and of course Marfa's getting just as bad on having affordable housing available," she said. The existing Skyway Gardens development was completed in 2021, said Lopez. Prior to that, Antrim estimated that a below-market-rate developer had not come knocking on Alpine's door since 2013, when the city turned them down due to concerns over what type of clientele it would attract. Eves hypothesized that developers had been hesitant to build in Alpine due to its infrastructure issues. Whatever the reason, it was clear from council members' discussion that 44 new units of housing did not come across their desks frequently, and all agreed that such an opportunity should not be turned away. "A new community has not opened up in Alpine in a very long time," said Rodriguez. "We've had issues trying to get anyone to take a chance on Alpine." Fired administrator's wrongful termination claim against City of Presidio results in confidential settlement. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Presidio. In August of 2022, former city administrator Brad Newton filed a wrongful termination claim against the City of Presidio. A settlement has since been reached, according to the mayor and city secretary, but officials say they are not privy to the terms of the settlement. Officials maintain that documentation and details of the settlement were never communicated with the city. They only learned of its existence when rumors began circulating, and that their legal counsel would not disclose those details to them when asked. The law firm representing the city, Bohorquez Law Firm, P.C., did not return repeated requests for comment. When reached by phone Wednesday morning in a final attempt to request comment, a representative of the law firm hung up on the Presidio International mid-inquiry. When the International called back, the person who answered the phone abruptly stated, "We're not going to be making any comments at this time," before hanging up again. Neither Newton nor his attorney, John A. Wienke, returned repeated requests for comment. Newton's notice of legal claims, obtained by the Presidio International through a public records request, accuses the city of firing him without good cause, in breach of his contract, and in retaliation for taking protected family and medical leave. Newton was fired by the City Council on April 4, 2022. Council members declined to comment to the Presidio International about the reasoning behind Newton's termination, though all present voted in support after an extended discussion in closed session. Mayor John Ferguson was the sole dissenting voice. At the same meeting, he expressed appreciation for Newton's service to the city in various capacities for nearly 13 years. "Over the past year, you've led Presidio out of some of our darkest times," he said. Texas is an at-will employment state, meaning that employees can be terminated at any time for any reason. But jobs under contract, including the position of Presidio City Administrator, are subject to different rules. The letter sent to Mayor John Ferguson by Newton's legal counsel argued that counsel's decision was a breach of contract. Per Newton's contract, he could only be terminated with good cause in the case of any willful disregard or habitual neglect of his duties as city administrator, misconduct involving a crime of moral turpitude or criminal legality, or misuse of taxpayer money. Newton's lawyer argued that an explanation of good cause under these stipulations was never provided by the city. No explanation of what constituted good cause was provided to Mr. Newton, and no written termination notice was provided, wrote Winkie. Winkie did not believe that Newton had violated his contract. Instead, he was a victim of discriminatory and potentially illegal conduct. He argued that Newton had not been given adequate notice of the performance issues by counsel, and that he was not present in the closed session where his performance was discussed. Winkie claimed that a vote was taken in executive session and Newton did not discover the results of the vote until open session. State law does not require the subject of a personnel issue in closed session to be present during that session. Additionally, official votes cannot be taken during closed session. Furthermore, Winkie argued that Newton was discriminated against for taking protected leave for a serious medical issue. Newton had given notice that he would be out of the office until around March 29th. He was fired on April 4th. Winkie said that the short period of time between Newton's medical leave and his termination was enough to prove a causal relationship between the two. Winkie also claimed that differing reasons for Newton's departure were given to Newton himself and to the Texas Workforce Commission. The city had told the commission that Newton was laid off, which Newton discovered when he applied for unemployment benefits. The notice stated that Newton would seek back pay, reinstatement and or front pay, liquidated damages, doubling of the back and front pay amount, and attorney fees. Winkie argued that the remaining time on Newton's contract would entitle him to approximately $125,000 in back pay. Should the claim become a lawsuit, each individual council member who voted for Newton's termination would be named as a defendant. The question of the claim's resolution has bizarrely emerged as a mystery for city officials. Both Mayor Ferguson and City Secretary Brenda Lee Ornelas Acuna maintain that Winkie's letter is the only documentation of a complaint against the city by Brad Newton. Through the rumor mill, they discovered that the claim had allegedly been settled by the city, though no documentation of the payout was provided through city budget line items or fluctuations in the city's insurance premiums. At Ferguson's request, Ornelas Acuna reached out to both Winkie's office and the city's official counsel. She was able to confirm that a settlement was reached, but that the details were confidential and the city wouldn't be footing the bill. "I have no idea how on earth word got out," Ferguson said, "but our legal counsel indicated that we wouldn't be getting anything in writing." Officials remain baffled about how the affair was handled. "You just have to wonder," Ferguson said. "Evidently, somebody had to pay somebody. Where does that lead back to?" Marfa ISD Board will not pursue bond proposal in May election. By Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. The Marfa Independent School District Board of Trustees announced on Monday that it will not proceed with placing a new school bond proposal on the ballot in the upcoming May 6th general election. The board had been discussing next steps since its $57 million bond proposal for a new K-12 campus failed to win voter support in the November 8th general election, with just 36% of a total of 800 voters showing support for the initiative. $57 million was the maximum amount the district could propose under state law, which limits how much a school district can raise the I&S tax rate. At previous board meetings, trustees voiced support for putting the bond back up for a public vote this May, but at Monday's meeting, Superintendent Oscar Aguero said the new estimates for building a K-12 school had shot up significantly since this fall due to inflation, and proceeding with the same project would cost the district closer to $70 million. Aguero said, considering the inflated price tag, significantly more than could be covered by a bond proposal, it would be unwise to attempt another election. The initial attempt by the board to pass a $57 million bond was met by pushback from locals who considered the cost too high, considering the district's declining enrollment and area's rising property taxes. Right now, it doesn't look like we could go for that, said Aguero, adding, the numbers are what they are. I can't change those. But the challenges the district faces with its facilities, including disrepair the board had hoped to address with bond funds, will continue, said Aguero. The superintendent and trustees are now left to reassess how best to tackle those issues. The board is currently evaluating what construction projects it could undertake within its means. We are now talking about gutting some of it, keeping some of it, renovating, maybe knocking down some things, said Aguero. So the conversation is there. Claycomb Associates is Architects, an architecture firm focusing on Texas schools that offers bond passage support, which worked with the board to envision a reimagined campus and sell the bond to the public, is still in conversations with Aguero about how to improve campus facilities. The district originally voiced the need for a bond to upgrade its aging facilities, which it said was saddled by costly repairs and a scattered piecemeal campus that raised functionality and safety concerns. The district is now exploring the option of phasing its projects based on its lending capacity in the future, explained Aguero. The district has just under $6 million in outstanding debt from previous bonds passed in 2003 and 2007, which it is scheduled to pay off by 2036. We did talk a lot about trying to do this in phases, said Aguero, but it would take a little longer to truly make the master plan. Aguero said the district might choose to renovate some of its existing buildings, including the elementary school, which he said had a solid exterior but could use an interior overhaul. Under the previous bond-funded plan, the elementary school was slated for demolition to make way for a unified K-12 campus. Costs for that project could total around $18 million. He said he was waiting on estimates to see what it would cost to add additional career technical education, CTE, spaces, and upgrade the district's existing science labs. The board is also considering the strategy of placing individual propositions on the ballot, said Aguero, as opposed to one sweeping initiative. For example, it could place a few more specific propositions on the ballot, like one for the elementary school renovation, one for safety and security upgrades, and more, allowing the community to pick and choose what they support. Those propositions are a lot more specific because when we said we're doing a new K-12 school, it covered a lot of things, said Aguero. The district will continue to work with Claycomb Associates Architects, said Aguero. The firm has not yet been paid by the district, but will be contracted to complete any forthcoming construction and renovation projects that result from passing bonds. Aguero said he felt the firm was invested in facilitating a more updated building that will really facilitate the great things that are happening here. Board President Teresa Nunez urged the need for more public involvement in future school district bond planning, including hearing more student perspectives to help inform the process. The series of public meetings the board held over this past summer to gather public feedback for the bond were sparsely attended. Let's get the school, the students involved. This is their school too, and get their voices heard and bring them in, said Nunez. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Junior high and high school principal Lou Ann Porter gives a presentation to the Marfa ISD Board of Trustees, teachers, and students on the details of the district switching to a 4-day school week. Marfa schools adopt 4-day instructional week for 2023-24 school year. By Mary Cantrell, MKZINTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. Starting next school year, Marfa ISD will break from the traditional 5-day instructional week and instead operate on a 4-day week spanning Mondays through Thursdays. Fridays will become flexible work days set aside for tutoring, parent-teacher conferences, and more. Out-of-classroom aid that proponents of the plan believe will benefit both students and teachers. The decision was made at a well-attended board meeting at noon on Monday, where teachers gathered to voice their support for the new schedule, and district administrators emphasized largely positive feedback from surveyed parents. Marfa ISD leaders have argued the schedule change by giving teachers more preparation time and students the opportunity for more individualized instruction would address some of the district's challenges, declining enrollment, low attendance rates, and teacher retention and recruitment. As it stands, teachers are spending time grading on nights and weekends in order to keep up with the pace of the school year, said junior high and high school principal Lou Ann Porter. I guarantee every single teacher that we have wants to do their very best. They want to provide the very best education for their kids, said Porter. They do it for the love of the kids, and they take pride in what they're doing. When do they get this extra time to plan, prepare, grade, do everything else that they need to do? In the evenings before the bell rings on weekends. The board first considered the change in November, then moved to survey parents, teachers, and students in fifth grade and up. In total, 94 parents responded to the survey. The district's current enrollment is 233 students, but a number of families have more than one child in the schools, explained Porter in a follow-up interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, leading administrators to believe over half of parents responded to the survey. 73.4% of those 94 parents who took the survey were in favor of the 4-day school week, with 16% voting against and 10% voting maybe. Parents were also surveyed on what child care methods they were most likely to use on Fridays, with 56.4% reporting no child care was needed, 21.3% reporting they would use other family members, and 8.5% reporting they would opt for a paid child care provider. 87.5% of the 72 students surveyed were in favor of the 4-day week schedule, and 86.5% of the 37 staff members surveyed, out of a total of 59 district employees, supported the plan. Surveys were distributed solely in English. Staff members assisted some Spanish-speaking parents in filling out the survey over the phone and in person, said Aguero. The district will still meet its state requirements of 75,600 minutes of instruction time for students and will likely opt to extend school days by 30 minutes. The new schedule will not affect teacher salaries, and the district does not anticipate saving a significant amount of money, since facilities and buses will still be up and running some Fridays, said Aguero in a follow-up call with the Big Bend Sentinel. Other rural districts across the state have recently adopted the four-day model as a means to attract and keep more teachers. The Texas Classroom Teachers Association estimates over 40 districts across Texas use a four-day week, and that around 27 made the switch this school year. The move comes during a time of low teacher job satisfaction, with educators leaving the profession across the nation in increasing numbers. A 2022 study conducted by the Charles Butt Foundation found 77% of over 1,000 Texas public school teachers surveyed said they were considering leaving the profession, a 9% jump from the previous year and a 19% increase from 2020. Teachers pointed to low pay, increased workloads, pressure to raise test scores and perform non-instructional tasks, and lack of planning time as reasons for their dissatisfaction. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, over half of U.S. public schools were understaffed for the current school year, with 69% reporting a lack of candidates vying for open teaching positions as their main challenge. This rings true in Marfa, according to staffer Jessica Murphy, who said she found the applicant pool to be sparse when assisting in hiring last year. At Monday's meeting, 10 MISD staff members, the majority of whom were teachers, addressed the board. The move comes during a time of low teacher job satisfaction, with educators leaving the profession across the nation in increasing numbers. A 2022 study conducted by the Charles Butt Foundation found 77% of over 1,000 Texas public school teachers surveyed said they were considering leaving the profession, a 9% jump from the previous year and a 19% increase from 2020. Teachers pointed to low pay, increased workloads, pressure to raise test scores and perform non-instructional tasks, and lack of planning time as reasons for their dissatisfaction. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, over half of U.S. public schools were understaffed for the current school year, with 69% reporting a lack of candidates vying for open teaching positions as their main challenge. This rings true in Marfa, according to staffer Jessica Murphy, who said she found the applicant pool to be sparse when assisting in hiring last year. At Monday's meeting, 10 MISD staff members, the majority of whom were teachers, addressed the board to express support for the four-day model. They said the four-day week would allow them to target students who need additional support on Fridays, and the flexibility of more time to grade, plan, and collaborate with other staff members would help prevent burnout, which in turn would improve student performance. Melissa Furman, special education teacher for the junior high and high school, said she was in support of the four-day week because it would offer special ed students more downtime, family time, and community experiences that would help them thrive. She also argued that it would decrease absences special ed students accrue when they need mental health days or days for medical appointments. Rosa Martinez, special education teacher for the elementary school, said the four-day week would allow her to focus on addressing behavioral issues and improving social skills with the students she works with. Early intervention is the best policy for any child, whether they have a disability or not. If we can target that, by the time these kids are in second grade, maybe we can curb those behavioral issues so that they can have time to learn, said Martinez. If the behavior is not in check, the kid is not learning. Martinez added that she also works a second job on the weekends to supplement her income and would appreciate the occasional day off on Fridays. 32% of MISD staff have a second job, according to statistics provided by the district. Teacher and coach Arturo Alferez said he was in favor of the four-day week because it gives students more flexibility in their schedules to prepare for secondary education. I'm always telling students, when you graduate, I don't want you to graduate with just the diploma. I want you to graduate with a diploma plus more, said Alferez. This will give us an opportunity for some of our students to start taking dual credit classes, certification classes, where they can use those days to actually focus on that. In a presentation, Porter outlined the biggest challenges causing the district to consider the four-day solution. Enrollment is in decline, down to 233 students from last year's 264, as is the district's attendance rate, which is currently at around 92% and frequently dips below 96%. As state funding opportunities are in part determined by average daily attendance, that decline is harming the district's finances, she argued. The district also sees a high absenteeism rate on Fridays. Then there is the high teacher turnover rate plaguing the district. 21 teachers left the district 3 years ago, and 15 left last year. Porter said they are expecting to receive 8 resignations this year. The board has accepted 3 to date. This affects our continuity and education. This affects our ability to replace our teachers that are leaving with highly qualified educators, said Porter. And ultimately, it can affect instruction. So what can we do to retain our teachers and not have to replace as many? Teachers, who often have multiple courses to prepare for, are only allotted 45 minutes a day for grading and planning, said Porter, which is simply not enough time, she argued. On top of that, teachers are required to attend parent-teacher conferences, other meetings, and training, as well as provide additional tutoring time. House Bill 4545 made it compulsory for teachers to provide 30 hours of instruction per subject that students fail on the STAR test. Overall, said Porter, teachers are placed under enormous pressure, and the current system leaves them feeling like they have little capacity for anything other than day-to-day demands. The state continues to ask more and more of our teachers. It's not just educating them for 8 hours a day and sending them home. It's raising them. It's teaching them how to use the potty, how to flush the toilet, how to come to school on time, how to be social-emotional learners, how to have proper police officer interaction, how to perform CPR. It's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic anymore, said Porter. Still, staff members were not without their concerns regarding the new schedule. Alferez, despite his supportive stance, expressed concern over the impact on parents with young children, given the lack of daycare options in the area. He said he was hopeful the community would receive enough advance notice so parents could start to plan accordingly. He said the district also needed to make sure there are ways to hold students accountable when they are expected to show up for tutoring or additional instruction on Fridays. Board President Teresa Nunez, who expressed support for the change despite her previous concerns over a lack of data on the new concept's impact on kids and families, suggested the district proceed with caution, maybe starting with a temporary pilot program to test the waters. What if it didn't work, she said. What if we missed a step or we forgot something? While the finer details of the newly adopted four-day schedule will still need to be worked out, administrators explained that students who rely on the district to provide their breakfast and lunch 5 days a week through the free and reduced lunch program could be given food to take home for Fridays, and buses could still run as needed in order to pick students up for tutorials and athletic events. Graduation will still take place in May, and athletics events will not be impacted. Board members ultimately chose to unanimously approve the new four-day instruction week for the 2023-24 school year. Aguero said the next steps will include garnering teacher feedback on preliminary calendars the district has already drawn up and setting protocols for attendance requirements. He asserted the idea that for the new model to be effective in improving student outcomes, teachers, administrators, and students would have to strategically utilize Fridays. The whole thing behind this is that Friday has to be purposeful. We can't just make it a day off, said Aguero.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, February 9th. Longtime coach, teacher, dies at age 80. Douglas Knight Ward, age 80, of Monahans, passed away on February 5th in Monahans with his family by his side. Doug was born in Santa Fe, New Mexico, to Tom and Dorothy Ward on January 19, 1943. Doug grew up in Birmingham, Michigan. He graduated from Seaholm High School in 1961. Doug spent the next 7 years attending Sol Ross University in Alpine. He graduated with a BA in business and a master's degree in English. Doug married the love of his life, Christine, on August 23, 1968, in Alpine. From there, they taught school in California for 3 years. In 1971, they moved back to Texas, and Doug coached and taught English at Savala Junior High in Pecos. Doug's final move was to Monahans in 1979, where he continued teaching and coaching at Walker Junior High. Doug became head swim coach from 1997 to 2001 for Monahans. He was involved in numerous activities and organizations. He was an Optimist member, Little League coach, basketball announcer, summer golf coach, driving kids all over the country, swim meet volunteer, and filmed football games on Friday nights. Doug helped start the Weaver Johnson Memorial Scholarship that continues today. Doug loved all sports and enjoyed watching his athletes compete hard and act right. In 2021, Doug was inducted into the Lobo Hall of Honor. Doug is preceded in death by his parents, Tom and Dorothy Ward, and brothers John and Richard Ward. He is survived by wife Christine, son Steve and wife Christy, and son Mark and wife Alexandra. He is also survived by 5 grandchildren. He had numerous nieces and nephews. The celebration of life will be held Saturday, February 18th at 1 p.m. at the First Methodist Church in Monahans. Visiting time will happen after the service in the fellowship hall. Hines indicted for sexual assault of a child under 14. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Commerce man who was indicted last October by the Ward County Grand Jury on a felony sex charge involving a minor has been arrested and is being held on a $75,000 bond. On March 29th, deputies received information from the Benton County Sheriff's Office in Arkansas that was investigating a sexual assault. According to Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle, quote, Benton County Sheriff's Office provided information and informed Ward County Sheriff's Office of a sexual assault of a child under the age of 14 that occurred in the 500 block of Dumas in Wickett that allegedly occurred in February 2020. After further investigation, the Ward County Sheriff's Office received forensic evidence from Benton County Sheriff's Office, which determined Frankie Hines, age 54, had committed the sexual assault in the state of Texas. An arrest warrant was requested through Justice of the Peace Danny Bustos, Precinct 1 and 4, for Hines, charging him with aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony. There are two elements that make a sexual assault case aggravated, the victim being under the age of 14, and the use of threats, force, weapons, or drugs. The indictments state that Hines did intentionally, by the use of his finger, penetrate the sexual organ of a child younger than 14 years of age. Hines was arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail on January 28 on the felony warrant. He remains in custody in lieu of posting bond. The offense can be punished by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of 5 to 99 years, or life, and or a fine not to exceed $10,000. Ritter booked for burglary and assault of elderly person. This story was written by Christy Sullivan. A 58-year-old woman from Wickett was being held on a $35,000 bond after officials say she forced her way into a residence and assaulted an elderly person in the home. The incident began when deputies of the Ward County Sheriff's Office were called to the 100 block of West 3rd Street in Wickett around 4:30 p.m. on December 30th in reference to a disturbance. Quote, deputies discovered a woman, later identified as Connie Sue Ritter, had forced her way into the residence without the consent of the owner and assaulted an individual over the age of 65, Sheriff Frerenvalier said. Ritter was not on scene by the time deputies arrived. Therefore, arrest warrants were obtained for Ritter, charging her with burglary of habitation, a second-degree felony, and injury to elderly or disabled person, a third-degree felony. Ritter, of 205 Alpine in Wickett, was subsequently arrested by Ward County Sheriff's deputies on February 5th and booked into the Ward County Jail. Ritter remains in custody in lieu of posting the bond. Restoration and repair needed at 4-H Bentley Center. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. In 1989, Opal Bentley gave the Ward County 4-H Club the deed to 47 acres of fenced land with three houses, storage barns, pens, four water wells with an extensive irrigation system, fruit trees, a fish pond, and one barn with a walk-in cooler and meat locker. Quote, this is so wonderful, the possibilities are just endless, said Nancy Janes, the Ward County Extension Agent for Home Economics, in 1989. The Bentley 4-H Center is located at 3400 South Highway 18. Quote, the Bentley 4-H Center facilities have not been available to 4-H Club members for any events for approximately 2 years because the insurance was canceled, which has since been reinstated, when the property became in need of repairs, adult leader and president of Ward County 4-H, Josh Thurman, said. Quote, the main building needs a roof, and inside ceiling tiles are in need of replacement, as well as new paint inside and outside on the building. Cleanup of the area around the animal pens, fence repair of the pens and gates, repair of the animal shelters is needed. Also, the solar windmill, which is there to pump water into the fish pond, needs parts to restore it to working order, Family Community Health Extension Agent Haley Lacaz said. Quote, we also want to put in an area back by the horse pens for volleyball, gaga ball, horseshoes, and cornhole, said Lacaz. The center at one time had designated areas for many activities, such as the pens and shelters for raising animals, an archery range, an outdoor shooting range, a pond stocked with fish, a kitchen for food projects, barbecue pits, meeting rooms, houses with fully outfitted functioning kitchens, bunk building for when state 4-H clubs would come for water camp, and more, Lacaz said. The first Texas 4-H water camp was held at the facility in July of 1991 with the registration of 27 4-H members from across the state. The 4-Hers were able to bunk in the on-site dormitory cabin. The purpose of the water camp was to introduce 4-H Club members to the study of water quality, quantity, use, and other water concerns. The location of Monahans in the 90s was the best site to hold 4-H water camp because of being centrally located within 70 miles in every direction of major sources of water, according to an article published in the July 25, 1991 edition of the Monahans News. Quote, Opal Bentley wanted the pond to be kept up, and it was for many years, but we lost a large pond during the extreme drought a few years ago. The water levels dropped severely, and we couldn't pump water into the pond. Several of us have tried to get the wells going again, but time and expense are running against us. It will take a lot of work to reverse the wells, said Billy Riley, Ward County Livestock Board member. Quote, repairs will be slow as long as there is a shortage of volunteers, Jess Orndorff, adult leader and chairman of the Bentley Committee, said. Continuing the quote, we can use all the workers and material donations we can get. Anyone who can spend a few hours to help paint, cut weeds, or just generally clean up trash will be greatly appreciated. This facility could be so great for the kids if it is restored to its original condition, Thurman said. 4-H is more than just animals. Our local 4-H club offers interior design, fashion design, food and nutrition, public speaking, education presentation, and leadership opportunities at local, state, and federal levels. Kids can start 4-H when in the third grade at age 8, Lacaz said. Quote, 4-H teaches kids responsibility in many areas of life, from learning about raising an animal to how to work with others to achieve community goals, design skills. Areas of study include fabrics and sewing, designing and presenting, photography, filmmaking, art, learning shooting skills, gun safety, ammo. Local indoor shooting range is the Ward County Youth Shooting Armory, archery, forestry, and wildlife, as well as communications within a local community, county, or state government. Diversity of offered programs vary according to states and counties, said Lacaz. Quote, programs are taught and led by adult leaders who have passed the required background checks and have the skills to teach the area of study, said Orndorff. Quote, many week-long or one-day camps are available for the kids to attend throughout the year. One coming up will be on March 29th, is 4-H Day at the state capitol. The event is designed as a citizenship experience for 4-H kids of all ages to learn more about the state legislative process, as well as meet their state representative and senator through an office visit, Lacaz said. Texas 4-H is part of Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and the Texas A&M University System. Founded in 1908, 4-H is the largest youth development program in Texas, reaching more than 550,000 youth each year. Cardiac Rehabilitation Focus of WMH Seminar, February 16th. You might have heard the catchphrase, feed your body and mind. That, quite literally, is what we at Ward Memorial Hospital plan to do during our Lunch and Learn seminar series that takes place on February 16th. February is American Heart Month, and in keeping with the focus, the discussion during this month's Lunch and Learn seminar will be on cardiovascular diseases and cardiac rehabilitation. Respiratory Therapist Director Joy Arnold, RT, at Ward Memorial Hospital will discuss the importance of cardiovascular recovery following a stroke or heart attack. Arnold has been a respiratory therapist for 26 years and has worked throughout Texas. She joined Ward Memorial in June 2021. Patients with heart problems often need to see a respiratory therapist to help them regain normal breathing and general health. Heart disease is the most common cause of death in the United States, far outpacing cancer. Both men and women can be victims of cardiovascular disease. More than 850,000 Americans, on average, die from some form of heart disease each year. Approximately 92 million people live with cardiovascular disease or the after effects of a stroke. These conditions include congestive heart failure, coronary heart disease, or high blood pressure, among other possibilities. Quote, "We don't share these staggering statistics to scare people," Arnold explains. "Instead, we want to educate our community members on what they may be up against with a disease prevalent in our country." End quote. Heart disease risk factors generally include diabetes, high cholesterol, hypertension, high blood pressure, obesity, and high stress levels. People who smoke, maintain a very low physical activity level, and have a history of heart disease in their family are usually at much greater risk. Women tend to be at higher risk than men. Statistics show that African American women and other women of color are often at higher risk than white women. If you fall into any of these categories, it does not mean that it is a foregone conclusion that you will develop cardiovascular disease. According to Arnold, a thorough physical examination that looks at your weight, blood pressure, and cardiovascular fitness can help identify any possible complications and acquaint you with any risk factors that might apply. Eating a balanced diet that includes fruits and vegetables and exercising regularly can help manage weight, cholesterol, and blood pressure. Also, significantly reducing salty and sugary foods, red meat, and fried foods can help you develop a more heart-healthy diet. Those who exercise regularly are statistically twice as likely to avoid heart attacks. Most importantly, annual wellness checkups offer an excellent opportunity to chat with your primary care provider about heart disease and your diet and exercise routine. Quote, "We hope those diagnosed with heart disease or may be at risk for a heart attack will also attend the February 16th luncheon," Arnold stresses. The program should help kickstart everyone's thinking about these important topics and get us all thinking about ways to preserve and increase our heart health. End quote. A yearly wellness exam at the Sandhills Family Clinic or the Sandhills Family Clinic East is an excellent opportunity to learn about your risk of developing heart disease. Your healthcare provider can measure your blood pressure and recommend tests to measure your cardiovascular health. Arnold will lead the free lunch and learn seminar on February 16th from noon until 1 p.m. in the Ward Memorial Hospital boardroom. Lunch will be provided. The program is free to attend, but space is limited and expected to reach capacity. Individuals interested in attending are encouraged to reserve their seats by calling 432-943-2511, extension 177. For more information about local healthcare services, please visit www.wardmemorial.com or call the Sandhills Family Clinic at 432-943-2068.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.